You don't put it in there for fit?
We have a quorum, although one of the members who told me he would be late isn't here yet. Dean Erdahl is on his way. And
Mr. Chairman, if I may, yes. Some of us are going to be going back and forth a bit between here and Ways and Means, so I just would like the audience to be aware that if some of us get up and leave, we're working two committees at the same time.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Representative Carlson. If you'd give my regards to Ways and Means while you're down there, because I'm also absent from that committee. So, before we begin our agenda and our testimony today, I'd like to introduce our GOP researcher who is new. Sarah, you want to raise your hand again? And I'm going to take a real good run at this name. Nosneski?
That's correct.
Okay, wonderful. Welcome. Okay, let's also have a motion to, has anyone had a chance to look at the minutes?
I would move those.
Okay. Representative Cox moves minutes from Wednesday, February the 9th. Discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved. And those are accepted. Okay. Well, at this time, we'd like to welcome back President Runix from the University of Minnesota. And our agenda today, we're going to talk about the governor's budget once again and the reaction that the university has to that. And President Runix, welcome again to our committee.
Representative Reines, members of the committee, it's great to be back again. I've never had the opportunity or privilege to address a committee of the House or Senate on Valentine's Day, so I'm hoping this will be a good omen.
Love is in the air.
Love is in the air. I hope for the University of Minnesota.
You'll notice, President Brunix, a lack of red among this group. So I think we may have all forgotten.
I hope this committee is not thinking red. I hope this committee is thinking green. Well, anyway, as I begin, I'd like to introduce one of the members of our Board of Regents, Dallas Bonesack. I think this. I think he is the only board member here today, and also I'm joined by Professor Martin Sampson and Professor Fred Morrison, who are representatives to the legislature on behalf of the faculty leadership of the University of Minnesota. When I came here 3 weeks ago, I indicated that it was our aspiration, and I think a very worthy aspiration for Minnesota, to keep the university in the top ranks of public research universities, not just in the country, but worldwide. We expect a similar level of achievement and a similar level of aspiration for our coordinate campuses, our partnership center in Rochester, our research stations, and obviously our statewide University of Minnesota Extension Service. People ask me, why is it really important? In fact, some of us, Tom Sullivan and I, our provost, spent an hour with Gary Eichten on public radio just a few moments ago. And I'm often asked, why does it really matter to have a University of Minnesota in this great state? I believe, perhaps more today than ever before in my lifetime, that Minnesota needs a strong research and educational institution to address the growing and the continuing challenges of a global economy. The University of Minnesota, in my judgment and the judgment of many, many others, is the state's greatest asset and one of its best investments in terms of the global economy and the expectations that we have for our future. As a state, I believe we get countless benefits from the University of Minnesota, and that's what this budget request is all about. We're committed to do our part. I came before you and I talked about the concept of a partnership proposal, one in which the University of Minnesota would increase its revenues, be very good fiscal stewards of the state's investment, reallocate our resources internally, in short, to solve many of our problems. But I do not think we can continue on the path we seek to achieve for the University of Minnesota and our state without a strong partnership with you, with state government, and with strong continuing state support. So this is all about a partnership proposal, and I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to talk about what we have placed before you. In doing so, I did say publicly, and I'll state so again, that I appreciate the strength of the governor's recommendation for the University of Minnesota. We asked for $26 million on a biennial basis to fund the university going forward. The governor recommended nearly 84% of that request. But I'm here not only to comment on the governor's recommendation, but also to make a very strong case for even more substantial investment in the university's future. Let's just quickly review the biennial budget request from the University of Minnesota. We asked the state to provide the University of Minnesota $42 million each of the next two fiscal years. The 50% contribution from the university involved a projected 5.5% tuition increase for each of the next 2 years, and internal reallocation of $15 million a year, or $45 million for the next 2 years. Now, people may not think that's very much money, but I want to tell you that's a lot of internal reallocation to cover the cost and the investment needs of the university, particularly on the heels of taking nearly a $200 million biennial base reduction in the past 2 years. The architecture of the proposal is pretty straightforward. We asked for investments in areas called biosciences for a healthy society. These are critically important areas that we think are important to advancing the university's work in science, engineering, and medicine in particular. They're areas where we think we have enormous strengths and opportunity in Minnesota, and where we think the university has the opportunity not only to strengthen what we have, but also, I think, be world-class. A second part of this budget had to do with attracting and retaining talent. Talking to people recently in the last few days, I frequently remind people that if you just take the roughly 20,000 applications we'll get for the Minnesota, for the university's Twin Cities campus this year, and you ask those students, where would you go to school if the University of Minnesota does not accept you as a student, about 70% of them talk about moving someplace else. Seeking admission to a college or university outside of Minnesota. We attract students from around the world, particularly from adjacent states, a very high number of students from Minnesota who might choose to go elsewhere. And we also obviously are in the business of attracting and retaining talent, not only at the university, but also helping with that kind of gravitational pull for people who settle in our communities throughout the state. A third part of the budget proposal talked about creating and sustaining the infrastructure of the University of Minnesota. It was divided into two subparts. The first part dealt with the research, the core research infrastructure of the University of Minnesota, and the second dealt with what we regard as an increasingly important state asset, that is our technology infrastructure. The next slide gives you a sense of the scorecard. On the left-hand column, you will see the numbers that go with what I have just described. That is the basic core request of the University of Minnesota for a grand total of $126 million on a biennial basis. The governor recommended approximately $105 million. There was an additional $7.5 million recommended for the University of Minnesota as a part of the Mayo University partnership, but that was outside of the core request that we submitted to you and to the governor. So the difference is roughly $20 million. It's about 84% of the original request. The governor funded, this is another thing I feel very good about, he supported very strongly most of the parts of this biennial request to the state, the biosciences component, the attracting and retaining talent component of the budget. He supported the research support request of this budget, but chose not to support the 21st century technology portion. This is a That is to explain what is in the 21st century technology portion of our budget would take some time, but let me just make a couple of points. It's all about maintaining the national research and technology networks we have. It's Internet 2. It's participation in the National Lambda Rail Initiative, which I think puts the university and this part of the world on the cutting edge with respect to the most modern advances in technology. It gives us a competitive edge in pursuing research grants and maintaining academic partnerships, particularly with MNSCU, with K-12, and many other areas of our state. For example, we were able to bring the technological power, computing power that is necessary to support research in the biosciences to Mayo Clinic for a fraction of the cost it would have taken to transport that technology capability from Chicago or from some other place in the country. So it's not just an advantage for the University of Minnesota to invest in technology, technology backbone, and technology infrastructure. It's a distinct advantage to every other part of our state as well. We are the center of activity in this area. It supports the backbone for improving our educational programs, moving us much more into our online service economy for our students. It allows people from everywhere in or any place in this state through a portal methodology to access the benefits and of the university's research and educational programs in a real-time basis. So there's a lot in this technology agenda that we think is really important for the long-term future of the state. So I'm here to make a real pitch for closing the gap, and I'm urging the House to do everything possible to fulfill the full request of the University of Minnesota, particularly in light of the reductions we've been through in the past 2 years. Now, people ask me, what are you going to do if you do not get this full request? There are basically three options. I shared them with the House Committee the last time I was here. We can clearly reduce our aspirations. We've had to do that in the last 2 years. We've been sitting on some critically important investments to replace faculty who have left, to shore up the core infrastructure and investments of the University of Minnesota. But one of the things we can clearly do is to reduce our aspirations, to slow the investment strategy. But I want to remind members of the committee, as I did the last time, that in my judgment, that's a mistake. That's a bet we should not make in Minnesota's future. Everyone else around us is waking up to the fact that if you want to be competitive in this global world, you have to invest, and you have to continually invest to maintain your position and to maintain your strength. A second thing, and it's not a very popular option, particularly with Minnesota citizens, is we can increase tuition again on students. We're projecting 5.5 in the way of an annual per year tuition increase. I'm not blowing smoke. I will take a bigger recommendation to the Board of Regents than 5.5 if we do not get our full request. I can't tell you at this point what it will be, but I can tell you it will be north of 5.5. The third thing we can do is we can cut deeper. But I want to tell you it's not easy to cut deeper at the University of Minnesota today, particularly when you've already set a course to cut $45 million over the next 2 years. So it would be north of $45 million for these budget cuts, and I think that is on the heels of the reduction we had in the last biennium. Too deep and too fast. So I'm here to plead with you to take a new look at the budget we've submitted, to do everything you can to increase the governor's recommendation. But I also want to say that I thought in the context of his budget model, in the context of the state's budget situation, I thought it was a very, very strong recommendation, and I deeply appreciate it. Now, another question I'm asked that I'm sure you're curious about is the enrollment adjustment. What does it mean? We have never, to my knowledge, included or incorporated an enrollment adjustment into this, into the biannual budget request of the University of Minnesota. Typically, those adjustments are not substantial. They're more substantial this time, I think, because we have, along with Minsky, really stepped up to accommodate the growing enrollment pressures that we're feeling presently in our state. And you can see on this particular slide what the projected enrollment adjustment is for the University of Minnesota. I was asked at one time, what's more important, the enrollment adjustment or the biennial budget? I would have to say unequivocally, I don't want to make the choice, obviously, but unequivocally, the state budget request, our biennial budget request, is our most important priority. And I said so to the leadership in the governor's office. I guess the bottom line is, if there is an additional way to fund the university over and above what we've submitted as a part of our budget request, clearly we have additional financial needs, and clearly this money is urgently needed to cover costs and to also cover investments that we simply had to defer over the past 2 years. I just want to end with a quick note. It's very popular in characteristics in times of financial stress to say, can't you do more with less? Aren't you? Can't you manage the place more efficiently? And I would say in response to those questions, the answer is yes, we can and we will. That's a part of the commitment we made in submitting this budget and committing ourselves to reallocate $45 million. On this slide is a quote from our external auditor. We didn't ask him for this quote. He volunteered it based upon not only his analysis of what happened at the University of Minnesota in the past 2 years, but also the analysis of Deloitte Touche of other colleges and university systems across the country. And I think you can read the quote. The point I want to make is the reductions that were made in the past 2 years were not smoke and mirrors. They were real cuts. I told the board in the first year of the biennium, or before the biennium started, that we would have to balance the books. We could not move the problem forward and visit it upon future generations of students and future generations of faculty and staff at the University of Minnesota. So we manage these reductions in a fiscally responsible way. But I must be honest with you and tell you we also withheld investments in some very critical areas that we think are important to sustain the university and clearly to move it forward. I believe investing in higher education, investing in education at all levels, is one of the most important investments Minnesota can make in its own future. And I just want you to know that when you invest in us, we take our responsibilities very seriously. We will manage the public trust with the utmost of due diligence and make our commitment to move the university forward. So let me stop here. I just wanted to do a quick recap, make a couple of comments, and then I'm available at this time for your comments and questions.
Okay. Thank you, President Brunix. We do have some questions. Representative Carls.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in your response to a couple of points. And last Friday, I was in the audience when the Twin West Chamber of Commerce had the governor as speaker. And a young man in the audience got up and asked the governor a question, and he was obviously a strong supporter of the university, the young man was. And the governor's response, and I'm going to give you two parts of it, and I'd like to have your response to that. He indicated that if you compare biennium to biennium, that he was increasing the funding to the university by 11-some-odd percent. And quite frankly, was getting a rather favorable response to that from the group when he responded, and at least his body language and some comments that people made as we were leaving. So I'd be interested in your response to that when he puts out there that 11% biennium to biennium increase. Then I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
President Brunix.
Chair Narnas, Representative Carlson, I'm assuming that this also includes the Mayo Clinic recommendation. I think otherwise it's down closer to 10% or slightly below that. But we don't need to quibble about numbers. I think in the context of the state's fiscal situation and his budget, I do think it was a strong recommendation, and I think it would have been unfair for me to comment otherwise. But I think we need to recognize that if you fully fund the university's budget request of $126 million, and there is no enrollment adjustment, we still have less money in the university's base budget than we had 2 years ago. We took $185 million on a biennial basis out of the University of Minnesota, and we're proposing to put $126 back in. So we're still down quite a bit, and we've had to cover all of the inflation during that period, some of which was made up by very, very high tuition increases, 29% in the last 2 years. So we made up probably 45% of the $185 million reduction through tuition increases. The rest of it had to be made up by reductions, deferred investments, pay freezes, restructuring health care plans, and a whole range of other very, very tough actions. So, I'd have to say that the recommendation is strong, but we're still in a weaker position than we were, at least close to 2 years ago. And adjusted for inflation, the university's budget today is no better than it was back in 1987.
Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, the reason I raised that question, I mean, I happen to agree with you. I was opposed to those cuts last biennium. When the governor does get up there and he's got the bully pulpit and his response is the 11% increase, it makes it more difficult for those of us that are going to be your advocates to advocate when he puts that percentage out there. And I was interested in your response. I carefully said, as the governor did, biennium to biennium. Now, that's quite a bit different than year to year.
Yeah.
And how those percentages play, and I think there has to be a bit of an educational process. I haven't calculated what it would be, but it would be significantly less than either the 10 or the 11 that you allude to. If you look at year to year versus biennium to biennium, that would be part of my response. But at any rate, Mr. Chairman, my second question, the enrollment issue came up in that same meeting, and the governor again stressed this point. He said that those numbers were 2 years old, and therefore implied that, in essence, it would be sort of a back payment. Now, those are my words, not his, but he stressed to the group that those were out-of-date enrollment numbers, in other words, by stressing that they were 2 years old. So, again, what is your response? And I'm soliciting from you information so that we can appropriately respond to these comments that are being made to rather large audiences, and an audience that, by the way, I think would probably gravitate to be supportive of the university, just knowing the makeup there, but they were certainly being put at ease, that you were being treated okay on both points, enrollment and what I mentioned earlier, the 11%.
President Bruni?
Chair Norris, Representative Carlson, just a couple of quick comments. The university submits data to the state after we have actually accommodated the enrollment increases. And we decided to do that some time ago to avoid these unexpected roller coaster effects from doing it on a projection basis. And I think it's a smarter way to budget, quite honestly, and it's one that we're comfortable with. The enrollment adjustment numbers that are reflected in this slide, if you can you get back to the slide, are real. They are actual numbers, and the university incurred those costs. Now you might say, well, you've already incurred the cost, why do you need the money? I mean, that's the natural, the next, I think that's the heart of the question. And I would say, well, in other times when we've had enrollment declines, and as a provost under President Udoff, I had a scramble once with Mr. Fitzenreiter to find the money to cover the decline, that the adjustment was automatic. And so going forward, if we're going to adopt this as a budget model, I hope we will also equally sensitive to declines in the future. So if we're not going to pay attention to this legislation, I would urge you in the House and in the Senate to take a look at the legislation to see if it still serves Minnesota's interest. But getting to the heart of the question, what we did during that period of time is we did basically three things. We cut the university's budget in areas that I still do not think were in our long-term interests. We deferred very critical investments. And we covered the cost of the university, particularly the costs related to funding students, out of our hides. And so in doing so, we made some decisions not to fund some things that I think are really important. We froze positions. We took 550 lines out of the university, some of which I think should be put back. So this money, if invested in the University of Minnesota, I can tell you would be well spent. And there's much more that could be accomplished if this money was available. But I understand the position. If you only have so much money in the pot, and the question is, how would you like to have that money delivered? I would have to honestly answer the question. I would rather have the governor and the legislature support the biennial budget request, where we've clearly laid out our priorities, we've done our due diligence and done our analyses, than to get it through an enrollment adjustment process with most of the money non-recurring. If you'll notice, most of this money in adjustment is one time, $43 million. But clearly, the university incurred some costs in accommodating more students, and it did so by cutting other budgets and deferring investments in, I think, some critically important areas. Remodeling classrooms, fixing the technology backbone, hiring replacement faculty in key areas. There's no free lunch anywhere in this world. And so when we had to absorb these reductions, we did so by protecting students. In fact, the letters that went out from my office to every single budget area of the University of Minnesota said, first and foremost, you protect students. And so we took care of those costs, but we took care of those costs by eating into resources and other critical areas of the university.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I have my questions just to this point, so we're going to dissect this base funding a little bit further. I'm new to this committee, and so I don't have the institutional memory about this, but I think I'm understanding, and the previous slide of the side-by-side helped me to kind of see some of the choices that people are making, and the difference is only like $15 or $20 million or something, but this is like a $43 million, $20 million, 21 or something.
Yeah, you see, the 43 basically doesn't repeat, and so right. Under the formula, it's a one-time adjustment to deal with costs. The $15 million is recurring continuous.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm puzzling about this, and I like your I think you gave a good talk today. It was clarifying to me on some things, but I'm curious about the tuition sensitivity on the recurring $15 million piece and even the one-time $43. And I'm curious how those dollars are different to you. And as you bring forward your proposal on the previous slide with your hard costs and the reallocations and so on, it seems there must be some other reallocations and things you have to do to absorb that, unless you haven't budgeted that and you're just kind of hoping it comes. And can you explain that to me a little bit?
President Brumitz.
Yeah, Chair Norris, Representative Abler. It is budgeted. We don't have a choice. We can't do cost shifting, and we don't. And that's one of the things the auditor pointed out in his comment. If this money was provided to the university over and above the biennial budget request, we would take care of a lot of one-time needs that the university has from the $43 million, and we would invest in some areas that were cut and need to be restored out of the recurring dollars. And they may be in some areas outside of our current biennial request. There is no replacement dollars in this request, there are no replacement dollars for vacancies in the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota, but I'll tell you, on the Twin Cities campus, we are not going to let the Department of Economics slip. It has a phenomenal relationship to the Federal Reserve Bank. It's one of the best such departments in the entire United States. I mean, those are the kinds of trade-offs that you have when you're into a really tough budget situation where you take an enormous base cut adjustment, and don't forget, we ate all the inflation during a two-year period that I would estimate would be somewhere in the range of about $70 to $100 million. So it was really pretty close to a $275 million problem that we had to solve during this period of time. And most of it had to be through cuts, deferred investment, and increases in tuition. So if someone said by tomorrow morning, give us a set of priorities for this list, I could give you a set of priorities that would easily reach $100 million on a recurring basis. So there's real need. But in the context of the budget, you know, I've got to say that the biennial budget is the top priority for the university.
Representative Abler?
And these are meant to be friendly. They're not meant to trap you. There are questions that will come up later on. But these aren't those anyway. So let's pretend that the governor's proposal goes forward, and this is not funded in the governor's request, is that correct? This is zero. And so if this goes forward as zero, if it would the tuition increase, and if you, let's pretend you got the extra $21 million that could be found, would tuition stay at 5.5% increase, or would it go up to recognize some of this loss?
President Brunings?
Chair Norris, Representative Abler, the tuition would stay at 5.5 if we get the full funding request. The budget model was based on that promise and that assumption, and we would keep it. And if other cost pressures develop in the meantime, we would find a way to balance those by reductions or deferred investment. Short of full funding, I believe it's my responsibility to take forward a budget to the university's Board of Regents that I think is an honest budget to keep the university strong and to keep the level of service that we promised our students at an appropriate level. So the tuition increase recommendation will go up. But I must tell you that I'm deeply worried about these rising tuition rates. I'm a first-generation college graduate, and I got through my undergraduate and graduate education by working and getting scholarships. Coming out with some debt, but not a lot. I'm deeply worried about pushing these costs. They've gone up in 7 years, 81% at the University of Minnesota. And that's one of the reasons I'm putting so much pressure on the cost side, you know, to try to be as economical and frugal as possible at the university. But they would have to go up. If we're $20 million short, I can promise you that we will not go forward with a 5.5 tuition increase. It will be somewhat above that, but I think it will not reach double digits this year if we get the governor's recommendation.
So maybe I'm just trying to clarify the answer, and I appreciate it. So if the $21 million came forward, that would solve that little pot. But if this other money didn't come forward, that would also create upward pressure on tuition. Is that just a
guess? Put a lot of pressure on tuition. I think if it came through, I might look at the option of increasing even further financial aid for low and moderate income students, where I think we have a serious problem. I would look at some way to try to even blunt the tuition increases somewhat more. There's no question about it. The enrollment adjustment comes through, we can lower the cost of instruction for students. There's no question that we'd also look at tuition at the same time.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brunix, you made a comment early in your remarks, and I want to see if you can expound on it a little bit. You know, it's kind of my understanding that these budget issues that we're dealing with aren't unique to Minnesota. They aren't unique to the University of Minnesota. They're happening all across the country. Tuition is going up everywhere. The same kind of problems, same kind of pressures are being faced in virtually every state. But you made a comment that you said everyone else around us is recognizing the need for putting more resources into higher ed. Who are everyone else, and are there places around that we're actually seeing universities your higher education institutions being funded at a much higher levels, I guess. Could you give us some comments on that?
President Brunix?
Yeah. Chair Narnes, Representative Eastland, that's a very good question, and I hope I don't give too much of an answer. There are systems in places in the United States that I think are doing somewhat better than we are, but to put it honestly and fairly, the citizens of this state have a good, strong, historic record of funding education at all levels. In the last roughly 10 years, however, we have not done nearly as well. Minnesota, on a per capita basis, is now around 25th to 29th in funding higher education. I don't think that's worthy of the aspirations, the values, the commitments of the state, and it clearly is not lined up very well with the kind of economy we have in the state. This is more of a knowledge-based economy than you find in many, many other places in the country. Second point I would make is that many states are finding ways to make deep investments in areas called biosciences or in related fields of science and technology, areas that require a lot of money to compete. If we have to hire a new professor in some area of the arts, we can usually find a way to do that with our own resources. But if we're talking about putting together a new laboratory, as we did for Professor Taylor, who was recruited here from Duke University, to really do pioneering research in the reduction and prevention of heart disease, that's not cheap. That costs money. So across our border in Wisconsin, and I'll make one additional point in a second, they probably will invest anywhere from $350 to $750 million, mostly from a private sector conversion in areas of biosciences research. California just put together a $3 billion bonding bill to capitalize research in this area. New Jersey is making a deep investment. Florida has some deep investments. Michigan has got some money on the table that is pretty substantial. And you're absolutely right that other states are feeling the pinch of the economy. Other states are facing the same kinds of problems that we have with respect to rising health care costs and other pressures on the state budget. And I'm not oblivious to those trends, so they clearly are all around us. But there are places around the world, and there are other states that are at least making targeted investments to keep their research and development capacity strong for the future. And quite frankly, I must admit that at least in the last few years, we have not done as well as other states. I'm hoping that is not going to be a long-term trend. If it's a long-term trend, we can roll back the clock in Minnesota. We can be like we were in 1960. Some people remember the good old days, as I do. But in the good old days, in 1960, Minnesota's per capita income was roughly about 29th. In the United States, it's close to 7th today, and I don't think that's going to serve us well in growing the state's economy and preparing us for the future. Higher education, K-12 education, are not the only ways to prepare for the future. There are other things that you have to invest in to assure your quality of life, but I'd say right in the center of the target has to be an investment in people and continuous learning of people. If you're going to compete in a global economy where ideas are going to be the coin of the realm. So when I look at the trends, you know, the leading indicators, I find them somewhat disturbing for Minnesota. I don't think there's anything that we can take any particular comfort in because I don't think we're doing, I think historically we've done better, but I don't think we're doing as well in recent years.
Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brunix, the first time you were here was just after the governor's state of the state, but before his budget was released. You were rather clear on an item that I brought up that was not in your budget. I don't see it here today either, the Rochester Initiative. I'm wondering if your position has changed since the release of the governor's budget on Rochester. And if so, how would that impact the fact that you're still short, by your own admission, $20 million from the request that you have before us?
President Brunix?
Chair Narnes, Representative Pulaski, it's a pleasure to answer this question once again. Let me take another crack. What did Emerson say? Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, and so I want to be small-minded in answering your question. The point I would make and make once again is that there is no room in the university's current budget, or even budget if this recommendation to the governor and state is fully funded, to reallocate money to the Rochester campus. There just isn't any money to do that. In the $45 million that is scheduled for reallocation, that is going to be dedicated to covering increasing costs at the University of Minnesota and making some new investments that we think are critically important, in addition to those we've asked for in this particular budget. We're willing to work with the Rochester community, with our colleagues in SCU, to see if we can find better solutions there. I'm open to working through some process if the governor comes forward with a recommended study process and study commission. We'll do our part, but there isn't any money in the game, at least on the university side of the fence, to greatly grow any presence that we would have in Rochester at this time. But we're committed to the community, we'll work with the community, we'll work with Mayor, we'll work with Minsky, we'll do whatever we can, but there's no quick fix financially in terms of Rochester's needs at the present time.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, President Bruce, thank you. I thought that was very
consistent.
I think that was very consistent. Hobgoblin would be in the governor's budget, not in your answer, but I have one more question. I asked it to you last week, and I think it bears repetition here. Can you react to the governor's comparison of Colorado and its higher education system and any aspect of that that we might want to use here in Minnesota?
President Brunix?
Chair Narnas, Representative Pulaski, what I thought was interesting is the executive director of the Western Commission on Higher Education, and I believe it's located in Denver, said unequivocally that Minnesota should not have any thought of emulating Colorado. I think most knowledgeable people who study higher education and trends in higher education view Colorado with great alarm. I think it's close to a disaster area in higher education. The money followed the student model was basically, in my judgment, a triage concept. There was no other way to get money to higher education. So leaders there bought into the concept that if some money followed the students, at least some money would come into the institutions of higher education. I think it is a wrong-headed way to build the future of higher education in Minnesota. I do not oppose money following students, particularly low-income students who need an economic boost to make choices about the place they want to attend. We have, as I indicated to the Senate, the fifth most generous state grant program in the entire United States. In dollar terms, it's the fourth most generous. The average recipient in the state grant program, low-income student, gets about $7,700 from the state of Minnesota. So I don't think there's much in Colorado that I would want to emulate here in Minnesota. And my sense is that people, in taking a more careful view of that situation, will come around to my point of view.
Mr. Chair,
President Blasky.
Mr. Chair, thank you, President Brunix. I would hope that the committee would take your comments today to heart as we go through these budget negotiations over the next few weeks, because I think it would be a disaster to emulate Colorado.
I agree.
Your comments. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and President Brunix. Representative Adler and Carlson asked most of my questions, but just a little bit just from my own knowledge, also being relatively new to this committee. What happened in the previous planning in terms of the University of Minnesota's enrollment adjustment?
Relatively flat, right?
Yeah, moves 6 million, 3 million.
President Brunix?
Yeah, Chair Narnas, Representative Mariani. I think 4 years ago we had a $6 million decline. Is that right? Something like that? Yeah. And then I think there was a slight increase in this last biennium. I think it went up maybe a couple of million dollars. But our enrollment, that is University of Minnesota enrollment, was that close to, you probably know the numbers, don't you?
Mr. Chairman, without looking back, I don't have it right in front of me. It's like 6 or 9. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was somewhere in that ballpark. Our enrollment tends to be quite steady. This is probably the largest adjustment we've seen, probably in, I don't know, maybe ever. I don't know. It's at least in the last 10, 12 years, right? Ever. And that has to do with, the increasing numbers of students looking for access to higher education. Students tend to go to colleges and universities at somewhat higher rates when the economy gets soft. That's another reason. When people lose jobs, they often go back for retraining, and I think that's in part what you saw with the Minsky numbers. Our enrollment tends to be fairly stable. And it went down, I think, 4 years ago, about 6 million, and went up a little bit this last time. It's going up more substantially this time. The adjustment has been in statute, I believe, since 1994. It's similar to the K-12 kind of concept, if you have increases in enrollments. It was that kind of a idea that I think was extended to higher education.
Thank you very much for the presentation again, President Brunix.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and if we can answer any other questions, we'd certainly want to do so. While the challenges are great, we would deeply appreciate any effort the committee could make to a rapid rapid action on the bonding bill and to push the very limits with respect to funding the biennial request of the University of Minnesota. But I really thank you for giving me this opportunity to come back and answer your questions.
Thank you again, and we're all looking forward to the February forecast, which probably would be hopefully a sign of some positive things.
At least it's not going to occur in March, which is usually a bad month for anything in Minnesota.
All right.
No storms.
Yeah, we have our spring snowstorm in March, and we'll just
right around the state hockey tournament.
Yeah, we would at this point on our agenda like to move on to the reciprocity question or issue. And with us today is Susan Hegard, Director of Minnesota Higher Education Services Office, and you have brought some technology with you?
We did. We brought our own technology.
Oh, wonderful.
Have you all working?
It's a little inconvenient for the audience since it's behind them, but they're used to that. I thought it'd be nice to have a big mirror back here, but then everything would be backwards. So.
Work with the
kill that idea. All right. You may proceed, Ms. Hegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the Director of the Higher Education Services Office. And with me today is Jack Rayburn. Jack oversees reciprocity programs for the office as well as our college savings plan, the 529 plan. We're invited to provide an overview of tuition reciprocity with you today. And in addition to copies of the slides we're presenting, you should also find a handout that includes a more detailed account of the numbers for Minnesota's 2003-2004 agreements with Wisconsin. We've also passed out a story from the Star Tribune that shows Minnesota's standing on one measure of attracting brain power to the state. Let's see if I can figure out this technology. Under Minnesota Statute 136A.08, the Higher Education Services Office is charged with negotiating and managing tuition reciprocity agreements with neighboring states and with Manitoba. The University of Minnesota Board of Regents and the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Board of Trustees must approve any changes to the agreement. Last year, approximately 23,000 Minnesota residents took advantage of those agreements. And about 19,000 students came to Minnesota from other states to attend our public institutions under a tuition reciprocity agreement. Reciprocity has a long history in Minnesota. The agreements we have are well established. And if you look through the slide before you, you'll see that we've had an agreement with Wisconsin since 1968, with North Dakota and South Dakota since 1975, with Iowa, it's a limited agreement with just two schools, since 1978, and with Manitoba since 1989. The policy underlying all of these agreements is to remove non-resident geographic and admissions barriers to college attendance. We want Minnesota students to enjoy more options and more choices. And looking at the numbers of students who take advantage of these agreements, it's clear that these agreements have been successful. Parents and students are pleased. The Iowa agreements limited only to Iowa Lakes Community College and Minnesota West Community and Technical College. Today, the state of Iowa has not been interested in a more comprehensive tuition reciprocity arrangement, but as Representative Carlson suggested, I think a hearing or two ago, we ought to talk with them again, and it's our intention to do so. It's been several years since the last conversation, and we're going to be meeting with the Board of Regents soon to determine if anything has changed. One point I wanted to make also before we move on to the next slide is I have a couple of institutions that I've highlighted just to let you know the number of reciprocity students that attend those institutions. For example, at St. Cloud State, there are about 1,000 students that come to St. Cloud from states outside of Minnesota through a reciprocity agreement. Winona benefits from reciprocity. There are about 19,000 reciprocity students at Winona. Moorhead, there are about 2,800.
I misspoke.
Winona was 1,900.
Thank you.
And Moorhead's 2,800 students. Mankato enjoys, I think, about 1,000 students come to them through reciprocity agreements. So you can see that for these various institutions that I've named, reciprocity is a very important program. Wisconsin is clearly our biggest reciprocity partner, followed by North Dakota. You'll see that about 13,000 Minnesota students attend college in Wisconsin, and approximately 11,000 Wisconsin students attend our colleges and universities under tuition reciprocity. What we attempt to do on the slide is just to show you the flow of students to and from Minnesota.
This is a Mr. Chairman, members, this is a rather busy slide. I'd like to walk you through it. I think it helps explain some of the numbers that Ms. Hegar just presented to you on the previous slide.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jack Rayburn. I'm a staff member at the Higher Education Services Office. This map is called the dot density map. It's a map of population. The blue dots on the map represent 2,000 people. It is the states of the upper Midwest. The Dakotas combined have less than 1.5 million population. Iowa about 2.9 million. Wisconsin about 5.3 million. Minnesota about 5 million people. That's the demographics in which tuition reciprocity takes place. The green dots on that map represent public four-year post-secondary education institutions. The red dots, there's two of them, if you can see them on that map, represent the population centers of the upper Midwest. There's one in the Twin Cities. There's another in the Milwaukee-Kenosha area of Wisconsin and southeast Wisconsin. The thing I want to point out here is there are very, very few people in the Dakotas. Yet at the same time, for every 1.1 Minnesotan who attends in Dakota, there's one student from the Dakotas who attends in Minnesota. That's somewhat a testimony, I think, to the attractiveness of Minnesota public post-secondary education institutions to draw that many people out of the Dakotas to our institutions. Wisconsin, which is slightly larger than Minnesota, their population center in the southeast, is quite a ways away from Minnesota public post-secondary education institutions. Those red circles you see around the population centers are a 200-mile radius. Only one Minnesota public post-secondary education institution, Winona State, is within that red circle from the Wisconsin center of population. Conversely, there are seven Wisconsin public post-secondary education institutions within a 200-mile radius of the Twin City Population Center. All the while, for every 1.2 Minnesotans who attend in Wisconsin, there is one Wisconsin student who attends in Minnesota. Again, I think a fairly strong endorsement of Minnesota's public institutions' ability to attract students from reciprocity states. But what this map, I think, tells us more than any other single thing is that the flow of students is probably a function of where people live and where institutions are located. The bulk of the flow of students happens along the borders. North Dakota State, South Dakota State, River Falls, south in Menominee and Eau Claire account for the largest number of students flowing back and forth. In Minnesota, it's Moorhead, Winona, and the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. The next slide is the basic formula that is used in our Wisconsin agreement. It's similar to what we use with the state of North Dakota. And we sort of boiled this down to its most basic. Each state is responsible for the recognized instructional cost of their students studying in the other state. Now, what is a recognized cost? It is the fully allocated instructional cost times 64%, or what the economists call the marginal instructional cost of educating the next student in line. So, for example, if it costs $5,000 to educate a student, in the Minnesota-Wisconsin agreement, we recognize that cost at $3,200. Now, that's only the first part of the financing of these agreements. The next part is the student-paid tuition. So, for example, Minnesotans who attend in Wisconsin pay tuition at a rate that they would pay at a comparable home state institution. Now, what do I mean by that? The Minnesota student attending River Falls pays what he or she would pay at Winona State or Mankato or St. Cloud, for example. Minnesota student attending UW-Wisconsin at the undergraduate level would pay what he or she would pay at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So tuition is subtracted from the cost that we recognize of these students. The residual amount is what is left for each state's general fund. The next slide shows it.
Representative Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rayburn, I'm sure you'll go into more detail on this, but it didn't always used to be that way. I know it used to be that students would pay the home state tuition in whichever state that they were attending school. At least that was the Minnesota-Wisconsin arrangement initially. And then it got changed where essentially we pay our home state tuition whether we choose to go to school in Minnesota or Wisconsin. Was the idea behind that? I wasn't here during that change. I was actually attending school in Madison during that change. Was the idea behind that to make it a so that the tuition would not become an influencing factor in the student's choice of where to attend school? Or was there something else motivating that? Was it a financial issue like we're going to see on this new slide here?
Mr. Rayburn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Letts, you and I share that in common. We both took that tuition hike at the same time in Madison. I've had to go back and ask folks who were here why that occurred. I think there's two reasons. The first reason is Minnesota was in a general fund crisis at that time. One of the ways the state of Minnesota could reduce its general fund obligation to Wisconsin was to charge students more. But it also made good policy sense. And that policy sense was is at the time, you and I at Madison had a financial incentive to attend it. That financial incentive was taken away. We essentially could look at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and Madison and say they cost the same, now make the choice that is best for us. And so I think there was both a policy reason and a fiscal reason for doing that. At least that's what folks have told me. That occurred in the early 1980s.
You may proceed, Mr. Rayburn.
The next slide you see is taking that very basic formula and showing you it in the aggregate. What it looked like for the 2003-2004 academic year. This changes every year. But I'm going to walk you through this slide, this graphic, just so you have an understanding of how it comes out in the real world. In 2003-2004, the bar on the left represents the 300,068 semester credits that Minnesota students took at Wisconsin institutions. The cost that we recognize associated with those credits was $68.5 million. From that was subtracted $57.7 million that students paid in tuition, leaving $10.8 million for the Minnesota General Fund to Wisconsin. On the right-hand side of that graphic, you will see what represents the 313,000 semester credits taken by Wisconsin students in Minnesota. It amounted to $65.2 million in obligation from Wisconsin to Minnesota. Students covered $48.3 million of that, leaving $16.9 million for the Wisconsin General Fund. The two states do not write a check to each other. They settle up the difference. Wisconsin's obligation to Minnesota was higher than Minnesota's obligation to Wisconsin. The state of Wisconsin wrote a check for $6.1 million to the state of Minnesota in December of 2004. If you have any questions, I can address them. One comment I want to make on this, as tuitions have gone up, the portion of the obligations in the Wisconsin agreement that are borne by the general fund have substantially gone down. 10 percentage points in the case of Minnesota over about the last 4 years. I think the distribution here is about 86% students pay in tuition, about 14% paid by the Minnesota General Fund, or would be recognized if we traded checks. That relationship has been growing faster than in the case of Wisconsin.
Mr. Rayburn, we have a question from Representative Obatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you finished with your statement? Okay. In response to concerns raised by the legislature over the last few years about these agreements, the legislative auditor, as you know, did a rather thorough analysis of all of the agreements and raised some concerns about them and made some recommendations. Can you tell us how HESO is responding to those concerns?
Ms. Hegar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Opeth, I was actually about to get to that. One of the points I wanted to make is that we know that there are a number of proposals out there to change this scenario, and the net effect of those proposals would be to shrink that dark bar on the right. But you're right, the auditor has made some recommendations, and we're following up on those. We're in conversations with North Dakota and South Dakota, and we're also talking with Wisconsin, so we're fully engaged with those three states to work on the agreements right now.
And Mr. Chair, one of the issues that they raised, and probably the issue that, and we've had this conversation, is most irksome for the legislature and the public, really, is the increasing difference between what a Wisconsin student, to use the Wisconsin example, pays to attend our universities, particularly the University of Minnesota, compared to our own students. And there's been a wide gap. Our own Minnesota students pay considerably more than somebody from another state, and that gap is widening. How are we looking to tackle that particular issue, since that's the one that I think really, as we just had Dr. Brunix here talking about these massive increases in tuition, yet we have a lot of students from other states who aren't even asked to just pay what our own students pay, but in fact are given a heck of a discount. And of course, that then has to end up as a higher tuition for our own students.
Ms. Hegar?
Mr. Chair and Representative Opeth, sir, I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, I think it's important to go back to the primary purpose of reciprocity, and that's really to remove that non-resident cost and admission barriers for Minnesota students. So to go back to the purpose of it, you know, the result may not be something that we like, but the purpose of it is to remove those barriers. And so if the goal is to give Minnesota students more options, I guess we would argue that they're working now. That being said, it is very difficult when you've got a student in one chair paying one amount of money and a student in another paying another amount of money. You know, that's very difficult to justify, you know, people to understand. We have talked with Wisconsin about this. At this point in time, the indication that we're getting from them is that they're not favorably inclined.
There's a surprise,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
I thought I'd let you know that. But we are working on this, trying to figure out, you know, a way to make this work better. We're open to ideas. I know, as I said, there are a number of ideas out there, and we're open to talking with people about how to address this. One of the problems is that the cost, you know, to fix that problem is upwards of $6-7 million.
Well, and interestingly enough, Mr. Chair, it's almost exactly the amount of money that we're getting back from Wisconsin. So, I suppose that's just coincidental. But yeah, and the other thing to remember too, Mr. Chair, and I half of the students we've managed. A lot of the colleges and universities, public colleges and universities, have figured out how to be very attractive to not what we call NARNARs, non-resident, non-reciprocity students from all of other states and other countries. Half of them attending the Minsky system, at least as I recall a couple of years ago, of those students, half of the students who are coming from other states other than our reciprocity states or even from other countries are very attractive to Minnesota, in part because they don't pay an out-state tuition rate, but they do at least pay what our own Minnesota residents. So, we have found a way to sort of address this, what appears to be unfair to our own Minnesota students and to the taxpayers. And it's also true that so many of the students who take advantage of the that deep discount are not the neediest students in the state. In fact, our reciprocity students, on average, are the wealthiest students in the state relative to either the students who attend the University of Minnesota or even the private colleges, and certainly the two-year and four-year state university and state colleges. But
see, go ahead, Mr. Chairman. Oh, sorry, after she responds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wolpatz, again, we're open to talking with folks about this, but I guess it is coincidental that those numbers are similar. Just 3 years ago, we were paying Wisconsin, I think, $3 million or so. And so I think we're concerned about relying on an uncertain, income. That number could shift again. So I think it would be, we need to be very careful about relying on that number as a fixed number. But again, our estimates are upwards of $6-7 million that cost to kind of fix the agreement for the problem that you're talking about. And the situation at the university is somewhat unique. I think if you look at, other partners and other schools in reciprocity, you'll find a number of different responses in terms of who's happy with how things are working and who is not. And then finally, I guess I'd say that when you're trying to get us to get a better deal for Minnesota, and you have to really be clear about what you're asking us to do, because a better deal, there might be a better deal for some institutions but not for others. There might be a better deal for some students but not for others. And then you also need to keep in mind that there will be a whole lot of parents and taxpayers who might think that a better deal is something very different than what you have in mind. So I think it's really important that we're clear that this is complicated.
Mr. Chair, I know we don't have them on the agenda, and I see them in the audience. I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to hear concerns that I know the University of Minnesota has and they would like to see, as this disparity between, especially with Wisconsin and the University of Minnesota. So I have a chance to give us some of their concerns as well.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hegard, it would be helpful to me, if not to the whole committee, if you could at some point break down your last comments by institution, by student or student population, if you will, so that we can have a better, more thorough understanding of the impact of any proposed changes. So what you had to say was great in terms of general commentary, but I think in order to really understand this, we have to have it broken down. I have a question. Is the solution that is being proposed or considered with regard to Wisconsin and the other states essentially going back to the old system, which is to say Wisconsin students, if they came to Minnesota, would pay the same in tuition that Minnesota students are paying, so then two people sitting in a chair next to each other would be paying the same to attend? Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Lass, I'll have Mr. Rayburn respond to that question, if that's okay.
Mr. Rayburn.
Chairman Nornes, Representative Lass, University of Minnesota has asked that the Wisconsin undergraduate students attending the University of Minnesota pay the Minnesota resident rate, such that they've not requested that we revert to the pre-1983 arrangement where a Minnesota student would attend Madison or River Falls at the Wisconsin rate. So a long way around, it's the third option. If we have pre-83, from 83 till now, it's a third option.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rayburn, so it sounds like we're asking to have it both ways. We're asking to have the ability to go to for Minnesotans to go to Wisconsin and pay our rate, but then have the Wisconsin residents come here and pay our rate. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Rayburn.
Chairman Normus, Representative Latz, that's what the University of Minnesota is requesting.
But Mr. Chair, if I may, on that point.
Okay, Representative Opatz.
If that's what we're asking our Minnesota students to do, we're asking them to pay a much higher rate than they would otherwise, because if they go to Wisconsin, they're going to pay a lot more than the Wisconsin student does. So it's not quite as equal equation that way. We'd actually be saying we want it a third way. We want them to pay our rates, but we're not going to concern ourselves with what Wisconsin charges them, which is considerably more than they would pay under the current arrangement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lasser, we want to get a response from
yes,
Rader.
Chairman Nornis, Representative Latz, Representative Opatz. I think one thing that I think ought to be clear that may not have been clear from the Legislative Auditor's Report, the Higher Education Service Office does not set these tuition rates. We essentially try and have those bodies responsible in the states set them for their students. So when the University of Minnesota sets the undergraduate rate for the Twin Cities campus, that's what a Minnesotan would carry to Madison, for example. When Madison sets their rates, that's what a Wisconsin student carries to Minnesota. Now, there's what's called a 25% surcharge on the Wisconsin student coming here. I don't want to complicate it, but at the time, that was really a request by the state of Wisconsin to have that. Their intent was to reduce their general fund obligation.
A bit by doing that.
Ms. Hegar, do you have a comment also?
Mr. Chair, you know, again, I just want to remind members that we are open. You know, we're not saying no, but there is a cost affix to what we've been asked to do by the university. And so, you know, for those of you who have read through the information, that $6.1 million payment that we got went right to the general fund. But so we're open. You know, we would like to talk about it. If people have ideas, you know, we're very open to that. But there is a cost to doing this, and I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Representative Lance, you still have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hegar, I think you just answered it with my question, which was the payment from Wisconsin that comes back to Minnesota, even though it's essentially to recognize a different cost of the University of Minnesota, for example, or the institutions educating the students. The money goes into the general fund, not back to the institutions that are incurring the cost of educating those students. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lotz, that's correct, and it's not something that our agency decides. That's something that's written in statute.
So, Representative Lotz.
Mr. Chairman, at least for purposes of holding the higher education institutions themselves harmless from a reciprocity agreement, could that be accomplished by designating the payment from the other states to be distributed to the campuses where those additional costs were incurred?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lotz, that's something I think we'll have to talk about again, though. The concern is what happens, you know, at a time when the payment swings the other way. You know, we'd be talking about a very different situation, but I think that's something that we could talk about, but you have to change the statute in order to do this.
Okay. Ms. Hegar, do you want to continue?
This last slide, I think, is an interesting one to look at, and it's actually, it appears, Mr. Chair and members, this article that we handed out from the Sergeant Union that's titled Cash Flow to STEM Iowa's Brain Drain. It's on the back page. And what's interesting, you know, about this, I think, is that some people have wondered about the impact of tuition reciprocity on the economy, on the region, and also on Minnesota. When you look at how Minnesota fares in terms of attracting college-educated people, and I mean all college-educated people, we do extremely well. This slide shows the migration per 1,000 population of people ages 25 to 39, and those of you who are married know that when you're single, you're certainly a lot more mobile, so we thought this slide was interesting. Minnesota attracts young working professionals, though so too does Illinois, which is not shown on this map, and you can find this in your materials as part of an article on efforts by Iowa to stop the brain drain. But I think this map points out, when you look at our surrounding states, that we attract a lot of people to come and work in our state.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Lance.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hegar, do we have any information connecting the dots here. Any information on the demographics of the people that we attract, and if there's any connection between the higher education institutions they attended, and whether that was part of a reciprocity agreement.
Mr. Rayburn?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Latz, the dots aren't particularly connected here, yes. What we've done with this is just suggest that in this upper Midwest environment, there's something about Minnesota that's attractive. It appears that we're not losing college-educated labor to other states in the upper Midwest. The Legislative Auditor's Report, which came out a year ago, did suggest, though, however, that for those Minnesotans who attend in reciprocity states, a good number of them come home to work in the Twin Cities or in Minnesota in general. And I think this particular slide and the Census Bureau data that we're showing here supports what the legislative auditor did in that report.
Ms. Heger.
And just in following up, Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, that is something that I think that if there is some additional, I think it would be interesting if we could find out more about the connection. And so that's something actually inside the agency that we've been talking about, maybe doing some work with the department, with keep forgetting their name is changed, D, the agency that Matt Kramer heads up, that there could be some very interesting work done, I think, to show whether these dots are connected. We think that they are. And then I also wanted to mention that we'd be happy to follow up on your earlier request. I didn't really respond to that, but to kind of grid out, you know, okay, who's affected, you know, students, parents, taxpayers, et cetera, by a tweak in the reciprocity agreement.
Representative Blatt.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Heegard, my last question, I think, ultimately takes us toward the question that Representative Opatz was addressing, which is what's the net effect on the taxpayers in Minnesota, or at least one of the effects of a reciprocity agreement. In the end, do we end up paying more as taxpayers in Minnesota because we have a reciprocity agreement, or do we end up paying less, or is it a wash? If we end up attracting, because of the reciprocity agreement, however you configure it, if we end up attracting more highly educated, highly productive taxpayers who end up residing in Minnesota, we will have a net influx of income, productivity, and tax payments. So even though we might have, some might perceive some imbalance in the dollars that are flowing, although even right now we're getting money from Wisconsin, in the long run, this may serve us much better to have a system that does attract students from other states.
Ms. Heegard,
Mr. Chairman, paying
less in tuition?
Mr. Chair and Representative Blatt, I think that's a very good point. And I think part of what, you know, we understand that there are a lot of different perspectives on this. If you're sitting in an institution on a border, you're going to have one opinion. If you're sitting at an institution that's located probably in the middle of the state, you might have a very different opinion about that. But part of our job in the agency, I think, is to take the long view and to look at the big picture. And so that is an important thing, I think, is to step back and look at what's the overall, you know, net gain to the state. And we think that we do benefit overall from these agreements.
Representative Lights.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Heegard, if you could, if there's any way you and Deed or whoever can look at this can try to quantify that as much as possible, I think that'd be helpful for us in making our decisions, how we approach the issue. Thank you.
Representative Opatz.
Well, Mr. Chair, one source you may want to check out is a report that I did. It's up in the Legislative Auditors that did an economic analysis as best we could with the limited data we had. But there's no question that the more attractive Minnesota can be to seekers of higher education from wherever they are, not just these particular states, but across the United States and from other countries, the better off Minnesota is going to be. The fact is, with these agreements, more of our students are leaving than coming here. Now, that's not necessarily because of the agreements. That's just the reality that we have more students who attend in other states than are coming here under these agreements. But I think that there's a tremendous missed opportunity with attracting not just from these states, but from all states and from other countries, the more students that we can. I just think that I think the University of Minnesota has done some analysis that shows that that tuition differential, we wouldn't see a significant loss of students if those students were simply asked to pay what our own students pay. And so I think we would still be a very attractive place for them to come by not asking them to pay non-resident rate tuition, which, as I indicated earlier, we're not asking a lot of students from lots of different states to pay. So. But I did include some legislation, and I think we actually got it passed in the House a couple of years ago that addresses this important issue about tracking these students. And we ran into a problem. It would seem pretty simple that the University of Minnesota and MNSCU could share the database with, say, the Department of Revenue. You could see, you could identify, and we asked in these agreements that these other states would provide those data. It would be very interesting to see, of all of the students both leaving and those coming, how many are paying taxes in Minnesota. Then you'd have a real nice analysis of what exactly the impact is. But we were running into some data privacy issues. But I think we, you know, the legislative auditor recommended that, and I think that that's an avenue that this committee might want to pursue.
Mr. Chairman, as Representative Lentz, it just seems to me that if the current system set up right now is one which is more likely to attract students from other states rather than cause a net outflow of students. If Wisconsin can pay, residents can pay a lower tuition rate than they would in Madison and come here.
I'll let Peter Zetter answer that question. He's done some analysis.
Okay. Well, I mean, it seems to me that certainly there's an incentive from a tuition standpoint to come here, setting aside the issue of living costs and stuff like that. But if we can link the students, I'm not assuming students who come here are going to end up, while they're in school, pay more taxes by being here. But if they end up staying here,
that's what I meant.
Yeah,
5 years later, you know, after they graduate, are they still here?
And I remember, and I supported your legislation to get that data. I think it was 2 years ago that we voted on that. And we got to get around some barriers. If we're going to make a real serious analysis, we have to have that data to do it.
Ms. Egard and Mr. Rayburn, anything further?
No, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Is there anyone here who would like to comment on reciprocity from the U or from wherever? Mr. Zetterberg? Please identify yourself, please.
Representative Nornis, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work for the University of Minnesota, and I'll be respectful of your time. I'll be very brief. I simply want to make 2 points. First of all, I want to emphasize the importance of the state's reciprocity programs, not only for the University of Minnesota, but I think for all of higher education. They greatly expand choice for students in Minnesota, and for that reason, we should certainly do everything we can to preserve them. Secondly, last spring, the University of Minnesota did ask for changes in the North Dakota and South Dakota arrangements involving first professional students, and there's no real need to comment at all about that. But more importantly, we did seek a change in how the Wisconsin program operates, and although Mr. Rayburn didn't put it exactly this way, basically we would like the Wisconsin program to work the way the North Dakota and the South Dakota programs work, where a student pays the higher of the tuition of the campus attended or of a comparable campus in their home state. So a student from Madison, rather than paying the Madison rate who's on the Twin Cities campus, would eventually pay the Twin Cities campus rate. I'd also like to emphasize that we have proposed phasing this in over a 4-year period, and we have proposed grandfathering students. So if the full cost to the state might eventually be $6 million, the state would not, or actually would be a cost, it might be lost revenue, but if that were the impact of the change, the state would not actually see that impact until fiscal 09, the last year not of the coming biennium, but of the biennium beyond that. I think the actual cost to the state in the upcoming biennium would be more on the order of $2 or $3 million. And finally, let me simply say that the reason we've asked for the change is that on the Morris campus today, there's a Minnesota student sitting next to a Wisconsin student who's paying $2,400 less. And when that difference was $500, we said, okay, we can live with that. And when it was $1,000, we said, well, that's still okay. And when it was $1,500, we said, well, that's still okay. But it's kind of hard when it's $2,400 to explain why that is still okay. I mean, I can fly at 50,000 feet. I understand the overall value of the current reciprocity program. In the past, basically, we've said, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But we think it's gotten to a point where the tuition differentials on the university's campuses are just too great, and we can no longer ignore them. And that, in fact, is the only reason why we have requested a change in the Wisconsin Reciprocity Agreement. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Lance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I to understand you that what you're concerned about is the apparent inequity between students, and not at all about the costs of educating the students from other states who are paying less in tuition to come here?
Mr. Zetterberg?
Chair Norris, Representative Latz, yes, this is actually, obviously we would like to have the additional tuition revenue. That's a major factor. But I think the even more important factor is the simple unfairness of the current arrangement.
Representative Lance?
Mr. Chairman, is it Mr. Zetterberg?
Yes.
Mr. Zetterberg, if the state were to reimburse the University of Minnesota, utilizing the funds paid by Wisconsin, for example, to equalize the cost of educating those two students from different states, what position would the university take with regard to the proposed changes?
Mr. Zetterberg?
Representative Norris, Representative Latz. I suppose it might be possible, although very difficult, to take the money and perhaps reduce tuition on the Morris campus to make that part of the problem go away. I mean, if that was the problem you were concerned with. Obviously, if the money were directed to the university, it solves the revenue problem. But it's hard to make it solve the problem of the varying tuition rates. You know, no one minds if a student from another state is actually paying more than a Minnesota resident. It's when a student from another state is actually paying not just less, but very significantly less, that I think there's a problem that can simply no longer be ignored. And I don't know that simply redirecting the balance of payment to the campuses that actually incur the costs addresses that specific part of the problem.
Seeing no other questions, we thank you for
thank you very
your
much.
Information. Anyone else here to speak? I see no one. I think Representative Lance, you have a final comment.
Yeah, if we could get some information from HESO regarding, we know what the tuition differential is now at Morris in that regard, but if we could get some historical data on that, if we fly at 50,000 feet, I suspect we might find, well, I don't know, I'd like to see what the trend is, if it's gone up and down, if it's all trending in one direction. I would assume Wisconsin is dealing with tuition issues as a state, just like we are, and get a better sense of how we might project this out to the future.
All right, with that, our meeting is adjourned.